This is Palestinian Health in Palestine and the Diaspora, an Eco-Social Approach, session number 4321. It's sponsored by the International Health Section, which if you are interested in getting involved in more of our activities, we would love to have you. This evening, for example, is our social event and awards ceremony. excuse me, which is being held in room 258B at 6 o'clock. So you're all welcome to that. We have three speakers today. Our fourth speaker was unable to join us. So we will be a little bit leisurely, and we will have a good time for discussion at the end. So our first speaker is Dr. Panos Vostanis, who is professor of child health at the University of Leicester. Is that how you guys pronounce that? Leicester. You guys. It's like Worcester or something. In the UK, and he's consultant at the Leicester Child Mental Health Service. He provided a mental health service for children in care, homeless, adopted, refugees, and young offenders. Panos is involved in a number of research projects on the assessment of mental health needs, evaluation of treatment and services for traumatized children, and also he's involved in international research and teaching in Egypt, India, Gaza, and Pakistan. So thank you for your talk, and I'll sort of signal when you need to wrap up if that looks like a danger.
Thank you. As Amy said, I'm not a public health person. I'm a child psychiatrist. But I have always, apart from being passionate and enjoying the conference, I could only function within a public health framework because, as Amy said, I've been working with different vulnerable groups of children who experience trauma, that is, children in foster care, homeless, refugees, the different vulnerable groups. So I thought it was an interesting question. I've been working with Palestinian colleagues for the last 15 years, since 1998. It was an interesting question that I thought, how shall I approach this using child mental health as a case study, and then you can draw conclusions to have an interesting debate. And I mean, this topic can become quite emotive. So I thought, let's break it down. And I have approached from three angles. One is to look at themes, not at detail of the studies we've done in particularly in Gaza for the last, as I said, 15 years, to look how they compare with or contrast with the literature on child mental health in children and what helps. Look at the service systems in Gaza, in that particular area, and then link them all together and have a discussion how much public health can operate, how much is it constrained under the circumstances there. And first of all, just to acknowledge my colleague down there, Abdelaziz Thabet, has been a very good close friend because that's been his research for many years. He's a very productive, predominantly epidemiologist. And we've run two groups of studies over the years. Particularly at the beginning, the more obvious ones have been those that have been related to trauma. The circumstances there, the recurrent conflicts, but also the social circumstances. It is sad as it might be, epidemiologists' dreams, because the population is stable, cannot move out. So that was the main sort of focus of the studies, and particularly the first few years, it was not easy to do studies in other parts of the world, so they were quite sort of important then, and since then have moved on. So just to draw the themes, there are the obvious themes that the link between exposure to trauma and mental health problems. There's a lot of literature on post-traumatic stress disorders, started from the U.S., from Vietnam, some veterans after the Second World War. It can be a bit not controversial, but still a debate. Is it a disorder? Is it a normalized reaction for human beings? But putting that aside, if there is a group that you'll find very high rates, that's it. And also high rates of other mental health problems, emotional problems, predominantly depression, anxiety. With the theme now, just trying to break it down, it's because it's not just the trauma, it's what happens afterwards. Again, many good studies, particularly from the States, that was from with Cambodian refugees of generations, that post-traumatic stress disorder seems to be very, very strongly associated with exposure to trauma, immediate and can be long-lasting if not treated. But depression and anxiety, and we found exactly the same, is more strongly associated with the current socioeconomic adversities of, you know, being the refugee camps, overcrowding, and all the sort of social factors. And there is an interplay between the two. The mechanisms are different. Impact on children is both direct, that is exposure, what they experience themselves, like any other kind of violence, like domestic violence or all sorts of trauma, but also indirect, which is the most subtle and more difficult to break through their own parents' distress and traumatization. And in this case, you have a collective, and I use the word a lot, communities being traumatized as a whole. So, as I mentioned, the role of socioeconomic adversity that cuts across all child mental health problems, very strong risk factor, same here. And I will go through in a couple of slides of the different risk and protective factors in child mental health as a whole. I will also talk very briefly about interventions in another slide, but out of all the studies, as I said, the epidemiological ones got more attention at the beginning, and what children reported, which was horrible, and the ongoing sort of mental health problems that they would recur. But the study sometimes, when they give negative findings, they don't get a lot of publicity, although it was published. We did an early intervention study. It was during a period of ongoing conflict. It wasn't very well manualized and maybe sort of delivered. But we found no difference between running an active crisis intervention with children, one running through teachers and doing nothing. And I think that's probably one of the most, it's not a good finding, but actually it's what I would expect, that in the face of trauma, therapeutic interventions are pretty limited. There are things one can do, and I'll go back to them. However, the first thing you learn when you train in child psychiatry, child mental health, is first of all you deal with child protection and then you do therapy. That's the first thing you learn about abuse and neglect, and that's no difference. So that's a factor to bring in the discussion. And I will talk about sort of service models, what is possible under the circumstances. So that was the first wave of studies, which was the more obvious trauma-focused. In more recent years, last 5-8 years, we've run different studies on social determinants, which are the same in any society. Again, the subtlety here is maybe to think what is generic for all societies, you know, low, middle income, high income, they're fairly consistent, but also what is specific to the circumstances there. And I think the thing that cut across here is that all social determinants here are affected by occupation, by, you know, overcrowding, refugee camps, unemployment, closures, and so on. So we found, again, all these factors was often impossible to disentangle, but again, very high rates. We did studies with children in labor. Again, you find that in sort of many low-income countries, there are different reasons. But a lot of them were financial, and it was, again, very striking what one would expect. Not only they had higher mental health problems than the rest of the population, so even accounting for the trauma that they all experienced, but very strongly associated with longer working hours, not having health insurance, not having breaks, and so on. Again, with other children, with maltreated children, we did studies on the overlap between trauma-related mental health problems, post-traumatic stress, and even neurodevelopmental problems like hyperactivity, which one would imagine are fairly straightforward to distinguish, but they can present in different ways, and there was a lot of interest in that when it was environmentally induced and was biologically induced. So, again, just to summarize the studies, that very strong social determinants affecting mental health, but particularly specifically relate to the situation there. So how do they relate to what we know about risk factors to child mental health problems? So we know a lot about socioeconomic adversity, as I mentioned. That's fairly consistent. Actually, it's more about in relation to behavioral conduct problems than emotional problems, as here. Parenting factors are very strongly related. I mentioned that parental mental illness or how parents sort of are distressed. But the key, the mediating factor is usually parenting capacity. It's not, I mean, there is a small genetic component, but the main one is how parenting capacity is affected by external factors, and that affects how children are brought up and so on. And that's what we found here as well. Again, social and community networks and disruption, again, colleagues know more, the other speakers, but I think it's quite an interesting, very unusual situation there, because on one hand you have the closely knit networks, so you do not have displacements. I mean, you may have over generations there, but you do not have healthy movement either. It is like a big prison. So you have both factors, which again we found they act as both risk and protect factors to children as well, and how services can be disrupted by all what happens around them. Again, that's a matter for discussion. But there are also protective factors, where they always are, and that's a good, I don't want to go away with just a negative sort of finding. Again, very similar findings we had, very consistent with the literature. There isn't a single coping strategy that protects children, and there is a cultural variation as well. But on the whole, identity and the meaning that they can even attribute to conflict, how the ability to articulate, to relate emotions. I mean, these are all clues for therapeutic interventions, whether through schools or through other approaches. Family protective factor is the strongest one. And as I mentioned, there is that paradox of community disruption and support at the same time. And the memory I've got from Gaza, which struck me, and publishing a book now, it's an illustration there, because it stayed with me all along, was you could see all the tension and the arms and everything else, and there were tanks in the streets, and then with children, very young children, going to school on their own. And it was just, you know, fascinating contradictions in the society, that there was safety and there wasn't at the same time. And of course, the role of schools, again, the less provision, specialist provision there is in countries, child mental health services are not sort of great internationally, they're getting a bit better, but slowly. So school is usually the only sort of, the main sort of stable factor for interventions. So there are protective factors as well that give us clues for interventions. And if I pause here before I briefly mention interventions and services, thinking about children who have suffered trauma as a whole, whether, you know, it's war trauma, whether it is abuse and neglect, homelessness, a very sort of strong model that we use is, you may have heard of Maslow's hierarchy of needs, is thinking of that reverse triangle of keeping the child safe. As I said, if a child is abused, is neglected, you don't start with therapy, which may be at the bottom. You start with keeping them safe, whether you remove them or remove the perpetrator or whatever. And then you working a way down about meeting basic needs, physical needs. I heard yesterday about, hadn't realized how still limited access to water and how much families have to pay, housing, and I think there is a study on demolition and so on. I mentioned parenting capacity. So these are all the networks that keep children's well-being together. And we're moving down to education, to employment for parents, the community networks, and then we have services at the bottom. For me, it is at the bottom. Sometimes people go into war-torn zones and want to talk about counseling. But you need to put all these together. But they're not mutually exclusive. In good models, they're integrated. So I think part of the discussion, again, is to break it down, is to think how the circumstances affect each of these levels. I will not talk specifically about interventions. It's beyond the remit of the discussion now. It is mainly just to give a quick overview that it is possible to help children even under adverse circumstances. And there are interventions with, you know, emerging effectiveness. Again, a lot of these originate from the U.S. with different neglected abuse groups. There are predominantly trauma-focused interventions, you know, the first three, whether of, you know, using cognitive or emotional frameworks. And these are the more constrained with this group. If you skip to the bottom in yellow, and that's the example I gave, when we work with abused children who are in foster care, for example, even if they're exposed to parents and hostility, even through regular contact, therapy is really seriously compromised. But then there are other strategies where other, and these have been the most successful studies in this group, is where the aim is not necessarily to work through trauma if children are still going through it, but it's to help them deal with it better, to enhance strategies. And this can be very useful in, you know, in the Western society as well for adolescents who do not easily engage. And again, the two are not mutually exclusive. Again, involving parents and schools are crucial in their delivery in the real world. So the point here is that there is good evidence about all these interventions. There is some evidence that it's possible even within in difficult circumstances. But of course, the line in yellow sort of alerts us to caution on the limitations if children are continuously traumatized. So what's happening with services? Again, to correct me, you know, your service is much better for those who sort of live locally. Trying to think of child mental health services, again, within a public framework, irrespective of systems, we have, again, people often think of psychologists and psychiatrists, but like sort of the most severe problems, I'm talking about mental health in a very wide context. So there's another reverse triangle. The model that many countries increasingly adopt is called four-level, four-tier model, that the majority of children with a lower, if we think 1 in 10 children have mental health problems in any society, and if it's in traumatized high-risk groups, it's much higher. There's no way that services can see remotely some of them. So the key is, how much can one enhance input at a universal level for children who do not cannot access special services, who do not need to? So the top of it, which is proportionally the largest one, is schools, social services, youth services, NGOs, pediatrics, child health, probably all what public health is about. And that's probably the most important one. However, for that to work, you need links with the bottom of the triangle, no matter how limited it is. I don't think it's visual, it's a good one I've done there, because it's very small in Palestinian territories and in many other countries as well. And it's how specialists ROSA are used effectively. So not all children with PTSD, we need to say psychiatrists, they can't and they shouldn't. But it's supporting training, providing advice to schools to deliver most of the interventions. And at the sort of the bottom of the triangle, for those with more severe problems where one might need very specialist and costly resources like beds, day units, it's possible. Now, my impression of Gaza, actually, I think there's another paradox. I think accounting for putting the occupation aside, if it's possible for a second, I think compared with other countries of whatever situation you want to call them, of similar socioeconomics sort of difficulties, the services not only are not worse, I think they're decent to good. At least that's my impression. And I think the paradox is because of the traumatization, skills have been developed and people have come in. They may not be great, but I think they're pretty good. However, they're compromised. So there are UN schools, again, focused for interventions. The bottom left, again, you know the services better, the Gaza Community Mental Health Program was very impressed with their work in refugee camps with the social workers, the psychiatrists, the psychologists there. And there is some access, and there is primary health, and there are some access to, they're not child psychiatry units, but there is a bit of access there. So I think accounting for adversity, they're okay. The question is, how much they're compromised by the overwhelming need they have in other areas. And that's probably the key for the discussion. And moving on to prevention, which is my last slide, which is not, again, unfortunately, not the strength of child mental health. It's, as I said, it's getting a bit better. But looking at the different levels of prevention that is universal for all children in a given area, for those who are at risk of mental health problems, let's say in a very deprived area in Boston, or those in contact with courts, I work with youth offenders, with the juvenile system, or homeless, these are all at risk, high risk groups. And then you have the third level, where you have interventions for children who have developmental health problems. Now, the problem here in this population is that the first two groups merge, so there isn't a universal one because they're all traumatized and exposed to both the adversity and the ongoing trauma. So the first task is overwhelming, and the last one is that the level of need is very high. I mean, the rates of PTSD we found at the peak of conflicts has been at least 50%, and they do go down. Sometimes we did some beautiful, didn't plan them, natural experiments, but they go up to a point. Those with the really high risk factors remain at 10-20% even without any exposure. So what's the answer here? Is it possible then to have public health under occupation? I think my view is that it's possible, but improbable, at least looking at the evidence and contrasting with other situations which, for what we can compare them with. So it is possible to put in, and there is a hopeful message that one could put in protective systems at any stage, with any child, with any population. I think the four difficulties here are that you have a high level of need, as I mentioned, and it's interrelated to social care need, like most vulnerable, highly traumatized groups. The second one is that the risk factors are pretty prominent for etiology of mental health problems at an individual, but also at collective level, and that's more difficult to break. So one feeds off the other. And then the interventions which can be put in place and have shown some positive findings, not many, are compromised by both the traumatization but also the socioeconomic factors. So I hope that I have neither oversimplified nor overcomplicated a rather impossible situation, but that's where public health comes into, so I hope we'll have a discussion.
Yes.
Thank you. Excellent.